next case on our calendar is 98-17-27, Ohio State Bar Association versus Judge M. David Reed. Mr. Bry.
May it please the court, we would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal to Mr. Jackson. Mr. Jackson, I represent Judge M. David Reed, who was found to violate 4 or 5 outputs of the Ohio Bar Association for the recommendation that he be held as a resident. We have filed objections that the Bar Association, our objections are that the time violation should not stand as a measure. We all object to the use of a cannon to a former cannon to a in the scope in which it has been used in this case. Primarily, most of this case involves the extent to which a judge can properly be involved in investigating real estate. The difficulty arises, I say this from Judge Reed's point of view, because there are particular cannons that allow and especially allow a judge to invest in real estate. Current canon 2C2 and former canon 5C2 states that a judge may hold and manage investments of a judge, members of the judge's family, including real estate. Similarly, current canon 4F says a judge may act pro se and without compensation, may give legal advice, student draft, or advise documents to a member of the judge's family. And an action pro se is an interpreter by Judge Reed, but he can also draft documents for himself, as he did in connection with some of the real estate investments. And thirdly, current canon 4C1 says that a judge shall not appear at a public hearing except when acting pro se in a manner involving the judge or the judge's interest. And Judge Reed did on, I believe, around 4 occasions sometime between 1985 and 1994, appear in front of the zoning board, Legal Creek Zoning Commission, in connection with properties in which he had an interest. But in doing that, he has done actions concerned with the fact of not relating to but that he doesn't believe these constitute violations. There is no evidence, and in fact, findings of fact and conclusions of law by the board indicated this has been done. So there's no evidence that these his judicial conduct was in the improper case involving transferring money for what he had done. And yet, acting in his judicial capacity, when he appeared in front of these folks, he never called himself judge in person in that way at all. Let's take a look at the specific charge. In count 4, which is probably a watershed count when we are addressing how much be involved in investing real estate. There were sort of two parts. At first, there were 4 real estate documents out of around 16 in this 10-year period, documents from 1985 to 1994. There were 4 documents in which he included in the documents the address 45 North Detroit, which is where the county courthouse is located. It doesn't say judge on, doesn't say courthouse on time to meet, but it does say that address on several documents. He continued to use his home address on documents that were owned in the name of a business entity, such as I believe he had the Beaver Creek development and also Terra development owned from other companies. But he was concerned or testified that he was concerned with the need for pressure to fall. So, primarily between 1988 and 1992, in those 4 instances, he used the courthouse's address rather than his home address. When he was dealing with property owned in his own name, he wanted to make it a little bit more difficult for someone to track him down. Although he continued to use his own address, which didn't mean it wasn't directly on the deed. But the Board of Commissioners goes beyond it, talks about all 16 documents, and although there's 16 documents, the current tenure is a constant, which is matter about between 1 and 2 of the year of the documents that he has prepared with respect to property personally invested or invested in as part of a whole retail business with primarily the six funds.
Is there any evidence other than the use of the address that he made phone calls to his office and had the secretary thank himself with what he was actually doing? The classes in his office
doing it? No, there was no evidence at all of that. In fact, for the time of the case was Jefferson, she was the secretary that he had a business there. The sole connection was he knew three addresses of the courthouse on Jefferson City Center. But that was that the work found that there was no public necessity in operation to do the real estate office on the city court, as has indicated in his diocese. And I believe on both boards, both sides, in their briefs. As you mentioned with the other documents, you can't invest in real estate according to the canon. The argument that was made in the findings was that developing or putting together the real estate documents was a kind of wrong, and therefore it was a violation of a former canon 5A. We believe this is clearly erroneous, and being both the ethical considerations and the case law, which is that we don't practice law when we're doing something to make up. And they would allow us to prepare your own documents for your own benefit. We believe violating the canons which we decided in the current canon 4F. The current canon 4F was around the time, but nonetheless, the rules show that we are acting in your own behalf, as we was when we put these documents together, not practicing law.
That purchases the property and they sell it, and then he drops out of the partnership. No problem there?
But we're talking about, first of all, kind of just happened in 1992. The complaint wasn't brought until 1995. But it happened, was open again. I realize there is a case, but we haven't decided in the about how long this will go back. But I would suggest that the reason we don't see a problem there is because the conduct involved is conduct for which could not have been caused he was entering the ministerial order. And we're talking about the date of October 16, 1992, and October 27, 1992. There was a foreclosure action that was brought. The judge was passed early on. A particular piece of property, 633 North Robinson. They tried to sell a sheriff's office a couple of times. There was a brief order submitted by all the parties to allow to be sold, and he needed $50,000, which was signed by Judge Reed in May of 1992. It was publicly sold as a public option in August of 1992. And the confirmation of the sale order is the order we're talking about, October 15 of 1992. And I believe that the case law says even when an affidavit is filed in the file, it says still enter into the ministerial order. And the October 16th order was in fact a ministerial order. So again, there's 11 days between October 16th and October 27th when a partnership in which another partnership in which Judge Reed had acquired the property. The other testimony is that he had no knowledge or intent or awareness of the possibility of investing in the property. Would become a partner of 633 North Broad Street Company, and
Was the property purchased at public auction?
Property was purchased at public auction.
And were there other bidders? Does the record indicate there was any other bidders?
The record does not indicate that one way or the other. I don't know if there were other bidders, but I don't think that's in the record one way.
That's why I was asking.
Lee, I'd like to hear your comment about the role of these, the dismissal of the mayor first, and then 3 days later, the loan and so forth. What's your explanation of that beyond the brief?
Well, you're referring, I believe, to count three. And the undisputed evidence was he knew nothing about the mayor first loaning either the small business loan or any other loan that happened. I guess the record is 3 days after something he did in connection with the lawsuit with the minister for the tenant.
Do you think that part of the reason for the tenant that says that you shouldn't do anything that might create a problem? Because when you're in investment and in private business, I think the end of judge, you would have a higher duty to be aware of what.
He's not an investor who just gives brokers some money and says, here, go, make me some money. He's a pretty active investor. So the perception is that he knows when Ameritrust makes a loan to Wallabies in which he has stock. He probably knows about that. I think the perception, even if he doesn't, such a strategist, the perception is that he probably does. And isn't that the problem?
Well, I think you have to make a distinction. First of all, he's been active certainly in real estate investment. This wasn't a real estate investment. This was a startup enterprise, a startup restaurant. I don't think there's any evidence he ever invested in a restaurant, startup, or other one. Although I think that Magic House 10 is a shareholder and has in the corporation, so all that he really knew at the time was he'd given $150,000 to somehow be invested.
On that point, that's why you interrupted, but he clearly had two stories about what the $150,000 was for. First was that it wasn't the stock, and then later he changed his story that it was, or changed it, that he changed, and he said it, indeed it was for stock, and then reported on his on his ethics form. Again, there seems to be a building here of activities that create the perception that he's more than a patent, he's more than a judge who just happens to have these things happen to him.
Well, you mentioned the law, but I think he really was a judge and happened to have things happening to him with the merit for long too long. There's been ample opportunity to prove the fact by things he didn't have to get there out there that he had any knowledge of. And the board, I don't think there's been any findings of that. In fact, the findings of the board was contrary, that he had no knowledge of an American person's defense. The facilitator of the association loan at any time.
Mr. Bradley, let me ask you a bigger question, I guess. The panel here, the board here, finds four violations, four code sections violated, and yet recommends a public reprimand. I don't have statistics on this, but generally, if there are four clear and convincing violations of our code of professional responsibility, code of conduct, the recommendation usually is more than a public reprimand. How do we, if we give a public reprimand in this case, how do we, what reason do we give for making this case different than the usual pattern of sanctions that we give?
Well, first of all, I would suggest that the concepts that we are not very strong counts. Secondly, the conduct that is an issue is conduct that is done in the public life over a number of years. And there was no suggestion by anybody calling or informing that anything he was doing in terms of suggesting and demonstrating was in any way improper. Thirdly, there's no finding that he financially benefited from the conduct. That was specified in the court. For example, using the address of the courthouse, he didn't get any more money or less money from doing it. Nor was he paid to prepare the document for a host of people in the room he had. Frankly, I think one of the reasons for the recommendation of the reprimand is just a recognition that these are not very strong allegations, and it would very easily, in a certain reversion of court, to find that they should not be found in violation of law. So we should not retroactively impose a severe sanction on conduct that is not to this time.
Thank you, Mr. Bryant. Mr. Weaver.
Chief Justice of the Supreme Court made a plea to the court. I am Brian Weaver, appearing on behalf of the Bar Association. The objections we filed with this court went to count three. What we call the Hines matter, and to the sanction the Board of Commissioners recommended to the court after the panel and the board issued their found by fair and convincing evidence that these things are subverted through the court of accounts. And after the panel and the Board of Commissioners had found that we had established violations of the code of judicial conduct, and I believe three. Specific canons, as well as a section of the Highway Code, 102.02, on the disclosure. The evidence in the matter, the factual part of it, isn't too much in dispute. It appears, quite frankly, that from the period that we discussed before the panel, the hearing panel, from approximately 1985, to the middle of this decade, 1995-1996, the respondent who has had business enterprises before began to expand. This is illustrated by the evidence that we introduced that, for example, in 1988, he established two real estate investment partnerships. This is on top of the real estate investment partnership that he already had from 1994, and which continues, which is not presumably what has happened today, it continues with a date of The documents that we brought forth that he prepared were all legal real estate documents, deeds, mortgages, leases, and which he prepared for business property. None of this, none of these matters that the panel heard concerns any either personal property of the respondent or any personal property of any member of his family. For example, as the exhibits show, we introduced the financial disclosure forms for several years, and one I think all of them, as a matter of fact, show a Reed Family Trust. The Bar Association did not take up that property because we believe it's so permissive the judge to manage real estate of his family, and certainly of his own personal real estate. We believe the code then and now permits Darrell, the judge, to participate in business. But we contend that the respondent herein was a general partner and had at least three partnerships, all with the intent, and this is from all the testimony of the respondent, the intent was to invest, develop, buy, sell real property. The example of impropriety that we feel is startling is when the respondent participated in a purchase of property from an action that had been on his docket up to 11 days previously. The evidence before the panel, as I recall, obviously the record is that the bidder, there was one bidder at the auction. This was the third auction, and the price, as often happens, ratcheted down. And that the gentleman who purchased the property as the one and only bidder was a partner with the respondent in an ongoing partnership that had commenced, I believe, in January of 1988. The gentleman's name is Mr. Schaefer. And Mr. Schaefer responded, and Mr. Moorhead is one MRS property developers for development in January of 1988.
Is it fair to say if they hadn't purchased that property, that it would have had to go to a fourth bid and the price would, auction, the fourth price would have been lower than the third one, the way it usually works when we do those?
Because he was going there, I think that's a safe assumption. In that judgment entry that he filed signed, which we do not think was a ministerial act, we believe it was when the trial court signed a judgment entry, whether it's agreed to by the multiple parties or not, a judgment entry is a judgment entry. This was the entry that concluded the case. It cannot be, in our opinion, described as a ministerial act. And 11 days later, he and his partner from another partnership, the same as Mr. Moorhead, this is the ongoing 1974 partnership, joined with Mr. Schaefer and others in the 633 North Broad Street Company. And by the same property that Mr. Schaefer bought at the auction. And one wonders, and the bar does wonder what the citizenry is. Judge Reed invested. That, I should note, the bidding, I mean, the house in 1933 was in 1992. In 1994, Robbie's Inc. was formed, and the respondent was signed up for charity. No money was changed on March 6, 1995. At that time, Judge Reed wrote a check for $150,000 for stock. We did not list Wallaby's on his 1995 financial disclosure form. His explanation, as I understood it, and that $150,000 wasn't just, may have been an investment, except it wasn't because I didn't get the is and for the restaurant business. And note, the statute seems rather clear, although it's small. And like a lot of statutes, you've got a reason. And it says if you've invested over $1,000 in the previous year in a corporation, you've got to write down a corporation. It doesn't say how much you have to pay. Then you got to have a corporation. And we are told, well, no one's ever, this has never come up before. And I suggest it's never perhaps come up before because it was rather clear that if you invested and to respond to testify a significant amount of money, you remember that. And when you write stock in the memo part of the check, it's pretty convincing that you intend to buy stock. And then to say, well, I don't have to write it down. I don't have to put it rather on the form, makes you wonder. The 16 documents were all prepared during this period. I should have been 95, 85, excuse me, 97. The exhibits we presented were all admitted in depth and all stand uncontroversial. The panel that heard this case gave, I believe, extremely fair answer to both parties. Recommended it for the nominee of the president. We suggest that the number of violations and the number of years before you require more stern sanctions. Do not say that as lame or happiness.
Mr. Weaver, let me just stop you there. You've not mentioned what seems to be one of the primary problems. The Ameritrust loans, and his misconduct there. What, can you go through that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Simpson?
Ameritrust
First, I'm sorry.
Ameritrust First, which I think, by the way, found
out when I was
situation. In 1995, March 6, 1995, when the respondent paid the money for stock, $150,000. It's also the day, and this is a matter of Venture Society's description, in a memorandum of understanding which refers to a $600,000 loan. The testimony of the respondent is, and we asked specific questions. He never made any inquiries as to anything about the financial situation of the corporation and he had no knowledge whatsoever that American First had loaned Wallaby $600,000 in late December of 1994 and had no knowledge of any connection between American First and Wallaby. And as we pointed out, we felt that this was a individual, the respondent is an individual who has hands-on approach to the system, illustrates us the testimony that all the paperwork on his real estate partnerships, such as Carrot and Beaver Creek, came through his home. So we get to the time case that's gone on from 94 through January, involving America First in March of 1996. For the second time, Merit First was asked to be out of the case. The first time was when a motion of summary judgment was responded, overruled that. They filed a motion for judgment on the basis of this was sustained on the 11th of March. On the 14th of March, the officers of the law including the respondent's son, signed up on behalf of the corporation for an additional $70,350. The respondent said, I didn't know where First was involved with. And we were unable to show, quite candidly, any direct knowledge of the respondent with America. Our argument to the panel, which was unsuccessful, was that an individual who puts $150,000 in this type of enterprise, such as this respondent, who is exhibited such hands-on contact with his partnership process, and awareness of his business interests was not simply
Was this a general partnership?
I'm sorry?
Was this a general partnership?
Wall Street was the highest corporation.
Okay.
His other businesses were general partnerships.
Who negotiated the loan?
The loan was negotiated by others in the corporation.
Was it a corporate loan?
Yes.
Were there any personal signatures required to guarantee it?
Yes.
Was his there?
No.
Was he on the truth in lending disclosure?
No.
Was he on the disclosure form with regard to the distribution of the documents, the proceeds from the loan?
I can't answer that, but I would say probably not.
Was he on the closing statement?
No.
Did he appear at the closing negotiating the loan? Well, you would have asked that in deposition, wouldn't you?
His testimony, if I can, I hope I can repeat, is that he had no knowledge that AmeriFirst and Wall Street were connected in any way.
So other than a suspicion, because he invested $150,000, you have no concrete proof that he had any direct connection with that loan at all?
The only thing we have, Justice, is that his name was mentioned as a stockholder and investor in the corporation in the application and contract that was submitted to AmeriFirst.
I understand that. But other than that, you don't have any indication at all that he negotiated, obtained, was involved in the execution of that $600,000 loan. Does that rise to clear and convincing evidence? Because, you know, we tend, because he's a judge and because of lawyers, we hold each of us to a higher standard, and sometimes that's not fair and difficult. But there also is a standard in the rules that says it has to be clear and convincing evidence.
I agree.
And it seemed to me that we're talking about the inference of impropriety, because you used, I wrote them down as you said them. It looks like, makes one wonder, it would appear, seems to be. Those phrases indicate to me that it looks like, it might be, it seems to be. You use those phrases, that those are all wonderment to me. You were commenting on the evidence and those phrases being used. Seems to me that you have some doubt in it, and it would appear that because a judge is involved, it appears more serious than one would think.
The uncontroverted evidence is, as the Lord Al Hamid's recommendation, final recommendation to the court, there's no right to be changed or anything. The fact that he bought participated in the sale or the purchase of a piece of property that 11 days earlier was on his docket, there's no right to be, or it seems to be that he failed to report all of these as corporate investment.
Okay.
exhibit in this record are business property.
That is how you define business property.
Property that the respondent will not, both on the deposition, the hearing, or buying, or purchase, or real estate, or sell, either build something on it.
Then you got to look through that.
No, absolutely. It's allowed to do it. It's in some context. It's allowed to do it. As a general file, if he wants to be an investor or have to buy an apartment building to manage it for his family, that is fine. But what this respondent has done over that long period of time is give active hands-on participation, which I believe shows then and now committed to being an active manager, officer, etc., of any business, and we contend.
So you're defining business as something that has other investors, are you not?
That's correct.
Okay, well, that's not clear. In other words, if he were the sole proprietor the sole owner, or he and his wife were,
right,
he and his wife and his kids were the sole owners of any of these
properties,
it would be okay.
I won't say it might be okay, so I understand that's not really what's before you. Most of the property.
Okay, but I do think it's very inarticulate to say he's in trouble because this is a business instead of his personal right. He's allowed to
I understand your distinction. I'm depressed. My distinction is one thing, your distinction is also
another. No, you chose the term.
That's correct. I didn't differentiate my personal as opposed to a personal.
On all of those documents, if he were the sole owner, it's fine for him to prepare and file.
Right. If he's the sole owner, I'd like to take the code then and read now.
Right. That's fine. But let me take you to the other issue that was raised by some other questions. If a judge buys $150,000 worth of stock in a court, is that judge then charged with knowing who all of the landowners to that corporation are?
As a blanket statement, no, my client suggests buying $150,000 shares
in general ledger.
$150,000 in general ledger. The situation here was quite different. This was a corporation that was started, incorporated being one of his sons, and he, when he signed the subscription shares, he knew everybody's involved. And this was a business being built from the ground up.
So in this case, you are presuming knowledge based on the size of the corporation.
That's one of the reasons.
I mean, you're taking a leap of faith there, aren't you? Because you seem to acknowledge that if a judge owned $150,000 of stock in XYZ Corporation, publicly traded in New York City,
in and of itself, that
some Ohio bank had loaned a bunch of money to that corporation, the judge wouldn't be expected to understand that and recuse every time that he's in.
And we haven't gone into this qualification. There's a whole lot of situations where a judge may or may not be disqualified. It certainly has nothing to do with violations of the Code of Civil Conduct. And we think that this qualification issue is not really relevant to the discussion before you.
We have the names of the panel here, and it appears that it's really I guess they're all well-respected and good people, or they wouldn't be on that board, but this is a particular one. Judge Spellacy is the judge of the Court of Appeals, and the other two. I take it, because we don't have anything else, that the panel's recommendation was unanimous.
Yes, I would.
Do we know, have you made any inquiries as to whether it was a split board vote in the board, or was it unanimous?
I have made no inquiries.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Weaver. And Mr. Chester, Mr. Dry has used your time, which may take 30 seconds.
30 seconds.
Hopefully somebody will ask you a question. 30 seconds, unless we have somebody, unless somebody has a question.
What about wallabies?
There, you got 30 seconds.
Now you can talk.
Why shouldn't the salary be increased? And I want to tell you why I think the salary should be increased. I think that each of these counts are very flimsy, very flimsy counts. I think that the panel is absolutely wrong on a couple of accounts that's demonstrated in our brief. I think the public recommended for a judge who's been served honorably in his courtroom for 20 years, there has been no allegation that this judge in any way abused his office. There's been no allegation that he has not been a good judge. There was no evidence presented other than the judge's own testimony, and there's clear and convincing, and the requirement is clear and convincing evidence, and this court is bound by this judge's testimony just like everybody else is bound by, because that's the only evidence in the record. And I want to say, a public reprimand is made to a judge who has been elected four times to his office, and will be up for a fifth time. A public reprimand in the days of TV negative advertising is a harsh penalty that can well bring down and well prevent his re-election simply by his opponent taking me to ad and publishing the wrong TV. There is, in none of these instances, as for example, in the partnership business, there's no evidence that he knew anything about it because one of his partners set up a new partnership to buy the land and count for it. Doesn't mean that he had any interest or any knowledge that he would ever be invited to participate. He has been shown to be a passive partner in every one of his associated investments because he had a partner who actually managed the properties and did the work of magic. And he didn't let this interfere with his judicial duties whatsoever. He's a passive partner in every one of these investments. And it is true that he might have done something or should have done something is not in the record. And it's not part of the offense of the charge that he should have done something that he wasn't, that he didn't know about.
You've used your 30 seconds.
Thank you.
The case is submitted.
I just want to say that I think the case is submitted.
The case is submitted. You'll be